This week on Your Western Context, we look at how Alberta pays Quebec's bills, the mystery of markups in BC gas prices, and Alberta taking steps to take care of themselves. Also, we look at the firing of Don Cherry on Remembrance Day and the attack on our Canadian culture. This is Western Context, episode 144, recorded Friday, November 15th, 2019. Out of Whack. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back again once more in this week in November, and we're going to discuss the news. And, you know, this week we didn't have too much that initially cropped up, but oh boy, did we find stuff as the week went on, and stories just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, that's right. I think for the most part, this week was pretty quiet. There wasn't too much going on in the greater political sphere. The politicians seem to be taking a bit of a break at this point, but some of them are certainly hard at work, I'm sure, but not as hard at work as us, looking through all the news just to find a lot of things to talk about this week. And certainly we did find some stories that were certainly covered in the media much differently than I think a lot of us would expect.
That's right, and we've been doing this since January of 2017, and our whole goal here is to provide the information and context for you, the listeners, to put yourselves on the right side of the news, and in doing so, hopefully along the way, we'll remove all the media bias and sensationalism that comes with the stories that prevents stories from being showcased that should be showcased, even though the media prefers to chase their shiny objects. And this is the case of what we saw this week. We're starting with one of our Canada stories, and this is a headline out of the National Post. In particular, it says, "How Alberta Pays Quebec's Bills. Four charts show that Alberta picks up the tab." So this week was, of course, the week where the opposition leaders all met with Justin Trudeau to lay out what they expect for the next parliament, which has been said to recall on the week of December 5th, where we'll presumably see a throne speech presented outlining the government's priorities. And then the way that works after that is the throne speech will go to a vote, and it is a confidence matter. So one of the Bloc Québécois or the NDP will presumably have to support that to ensure that Trudeau gets to govern. And as we mentioned during the election, that is putting the cart before the horse, assuming Trudeau will maintain the confidence of the House, and we'll see that in December. And we're talking about one of those parties in this Canada story to start off with, and that's this week with Bloc Québécois leader Yves François Blanchet, who met with Trudeau, and he was asked for his thoughts on Western separatism and the rising ideas of Western alienation in Western Canada after the Trudeau government failed to win any seats in Alberta or Saskatchewan. We've talked about a few weeks back on the show, you have to go from all the way from Winnipeg all the way to Surrey and the greater Vancouver area to find the next Liberal MP. Now, Blanchet on this said that if they being Western Canada, were attempting to create a green state in Western Canada, I might be tempted to help them. If they are trying to create an oil state in Western Canada, though, they cannot expect help from us being the Bloc Québécois. Andrew Scheer called these statements insulting and disingenuous. Alberta Premier Jason Kenney said that Quebec should indeed support the industry that funds their government by way of equalization. And the media jumped on this, and they said that, oh, Alberta isn't directly paying Quebec to fund their government. And what we're going to do with this week is actually have a look at how equalization works. And the National Post did put together a good story on this, because most of the media has, of course, been saying Jason Kenney is wrong in saying that, and they've been highlighting the fireworks that they were expecting to happen with this week. And as we all know, in this modern age of media, if the story generates likes and clickbait online, it's a good story to run with even on the evening television news. So looking at equalization, it works by taking money that Albertans and other half provinces, as they're called, pay in the form of federal income tax and earmarks, and it puts it towards the equalization program. In the past 11 years, Albertans have paid $240 billion, yes, that's billion with a B, to the rest of Canada. Now, to put this in context, that number is 1.5 times the number that BC and Ontario have paid in the same period combined, and consider Ontario being the most populous province. Since 1961, Alberta has paid more than $600 billion towards federal fiscal balance. The other provinces that give money to this, as in they give more money than they receive from equalization, are Ontario at around $700 billion and BC at just a little bit more than $100 billion over the past time period. Saskatchewan, of course, pays into the equalization program now, but has still received more than it has given, just to give an example on that front. Now, broken down, this $240 billion in 11 years, which, when you think about it, were during tough economic times, relates to roughly $5,000 per year per Albertan that were sent to Ottawa. This is during a recession, during an oil price collapse, and during a period of slow growth that has been precipitated by bad policy both at the federal and provincial level. Economist Trevor Toombs spelled out the economic reality with this, that these high transfers are indeed due to Albertans having an above-average income level strength and economic strength compared to the rest of Canada. And anybody can see this if you look at a graph of the median incomes in Canada. Alberta's median incomes are the highest. Toombs also said that Alberta has the youngest population, which means that it contributes more to old age security and the Canada Pension Plan. Numbers from Canada's number agency, Statistics Canada, show that Quebec brought in $107 billion by the way of equalization since 2007. All of the other provinces are at or below the $20 billion mark in terms of money that they brought in, with Newfoundland, BC, and Saskatchewan receiving the least. Ben Eisen, a senior fellow with the Fraser Institute's Provincial Prosperity Initiative, said that these numbers are hard to ignore, especially the per capita numbers, that is the $5,000 per year. He said that the data should also promote a sense of cooperation and help Canadians from coast to coast understand how big Alberta's contribution is to everyone's well-being in Canada. And that, quite frankly, is it, that a strong Alberta benefits the entire country, and when there's an economically strong Alberta, it spreads across the entire country. This is what the Fraser Institute had to say on this. Liberal governments and the media have championed numerous times in the past 4 years the benefits that Statistics Canada brings forward, and here's the data proving that what Andrew Scheer, Jason Kenney, Scott Moe, and many others have been saying all along, and that is, of course, that Alberta pays disproportionately more, but yet gets policy foisted upon the province that ultimately holds it back. The media would love this conversation to be about the jabs this week that happened in Ottawa between the Prime Minister and the opposition leaders, but the graphs and the economic data and the economic analysis provided by the National Post here ultimately does speak volumes. And this is what Premier Kenney's speech at the Manning Conference this week aims to highlight, and we'll talk a bit about that more later in the show. Will others, like the new Trudeau cabinet, perhaps, or the media, look at this as well and change course? We shall see, and only time will tell.
Yeah, I think it's without a doubt the fact that Trudeau kept the previous equalization formula in different economic times the same as it was then. And the fact that he did so meant that Alberta would still be paying quite a bit despite falling on harder economic times. And the fact that Quebec is still receiving so much money from Alberta specifically, but some from BC and Ontario, but a lot from Alberta, and yet Quebec is producing surpluses and is still disparaging Alberta's main economic resource, it provides a different conversation in the media than what there should be. The conversation should be, why is a province able to create a level of infighting with another province that is literally giving them money, when instead the question is it's delayed and the media has distorted it to a climate change issue instead. And I think that a lot of people in the West this is something that really underscores what's going on with Western separatism. It's not the separatism issue itself. It's just the simple fact that we're still not being heard. And I think that's one thing that's driving a lot of the frustration that is coming out primarily from Alberta, but certainly from Saskatchewan and parts of BC and Manitoba as well.
Yeah, and you know, the media would like to distill this down to the fact that Jason Kenney and Scott Moe are being naive, that Alberta and Saskatchewan and parts of BC and BC in general are paying the bills for Quebec. They would like to distill it down and say, hey, this is a naive argument that your leaders are making. But the reality is, in the way the media works, is you need to distill these arguments down to a point where you can get them across. And yes, everybody in these provinces pays their income taxes, and then that tax money is split apart, and then that is sent and earmarked away for the equalization program. So it doesn't matter whether the province is sending the money directly or if it's a part of the income tax. The economic analysis shows it's on average $5,000 per year per Albertan going towards the equalization program. And to just illustrate how skewed this is towards Quebec, our picture of the week, which we post with the stories every week at westerncontext.ca, is really quite striking in that it shows just how high Quebec's taking in of the equalization program is compared to the rest of the country. And that picture speaks volumes. And that's why this is the story of the week, because that should have been the focus that was on equalization and the media and the meetings with all the opposition leaders and Justin Trudeau, but no, instead they want to focus on potential fireworks.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something that should have been mentioned more in the media when talking about this issue, is the different discussions that are going on with Justin Trudeau. And it seems like for a third straight week, he's almost flying in under the radar, and that the media is not really talking about anything that he is planning to bring to the table. It's all of this infighting amongst the premiers, and certainly there's been a lot of discussion on the opposition, but not really much focus has been on Trudeau and what he's going to be doing on this. And he himself has certainly been quite silent. And for a prime minister that has governed the country for 4 years, he can't rely on his inexperience to excuse away his silence on this issue. And I think that's something that should be noted by the media, but certainly wasn't.
Indeed. All right, we have a BC story this week, and some weeks you'll note recently we haven't. So what is the BC government up to this time?
Well, yes, it's been pretty quiet and pretty much smooth sailing in BC, as it almost always is. But there has been some interesting developments this week. And from our first story, Alberta paying for Quebec's bills, now we're switching to BC drivers in certain towns that are paying their gas bills. And exactly how much that gas bill is seems to depend on where exactly you live in the province, seemingly at random. And we'll delve into that a little bit more. But first, the BC Utilities Commission has completed its research into gas prices in BC and is standing by its finding of an unexplained markup of about 13 cents per liter in gasoline prices. However, it's also cautioning the province against moving too quickly to regulate the market. Now, rather than increasing the supply, the BCUC seems to think that the BC NDP government will go straight to regulations to fix this markup. And it cautioned against moving quickly, despite acknowledging that there is a possible need for regulation because the major players preside over a closed oligopoly rather than an open competitive market. And for those who don't know what an oligopoly means, that's basically a group of either people or companies that have control over a finite amount of resources. So, for instance, an oligopoly could be used to describe the telecommunications industry in Canada, where a very small amount of companies actually control the lion's share of who actually is able to hook up internet or their telephones or their TV. And this, of course, is one of the reasons why we do Western Context, because there is a very huge lack of independent media in Canada, and it's hard to actually get news from a source that isn't being parroted all across the country. But I digress a little bit. Let's get back to the story, and that the New Democrats are preparing legislation that would put the challenge back to the commission in sorting out the mysteries of the gas price market. And Premier John Horgan confirmed this week that they have got some ideas that we will be bringing forward in the legislature in reacting to the latest report from the commission. And he's referring to a bill that is expected to be tabled after the House resumes this upcoming Monday for the final 2 weeks of the fall session. Now, Horgan described the price difference as a gouge on local drivers and said that the problem isn't just about supply, adding that there is only one refinery in the province. And he said, quote, "We asked the Utilities Commission to get to us the straight goods on why gas prices were so out of whack in British Columbia compared to other parts of the country." And Cabinet Minister Bruce Ralston, whose jobs ministry includes responsibility for the gas price inquiry, elaborated further, saying that the NDP are in fact, quote, "considering legislation that would require industry to give information about their supply and prices to an independent regulatory body, likely the BCUC, for review." Now, of course, Dean Morton, who is also CEO of the BCUC Commission, welcomed that proposal and the proposed legislative direction, and indicated that the commission was ready to cooperate if the legislation were to provide it with more routine data from the oil and gas companies on supply and pricing. He added that the legislation ought to give the commission regulatory authority to do something with the information. He said, quote, "Certainly if we were asked to participate further in trying to unravel this mystery, so to speak, yes, it would be very helpful." Now, it should be noted that after the one-month comment period after the initial inquiry in August, five companies that all maintain huge amounts of oil and gas presence in the Lower Mainland and in other places in BC, Suncor Energy, Parkland Fuel, Imperial Oil, Advanced Biofuels, and 7-Eleven Canada, all filed evidence in an effort to explain the price gap, but the supplementary report last Tuesday said that the evidence was not conclusive enough to account for the 13 cents per liter gap. And it said, at best, the evidence could bring the gap down 10 cents per liter instead of the originally reported 13 cents. Now, in the report, BCUC noted that of the 41 letters sent to it by members of the public, 29 of them were from Powell River residents. Now, for those who don't know, Powell River is located on the Sunshine Coast, which is just northwest of Vancouver. And to get to Powell River, you do have to take a ferry, either from the Lower Mainland or from Vancouver Island. And unlike Metro Vancouver, where price fluctuations have led to frustration at the pumps, prices in the northern Sunshine Coast community have been stuck at $1.59.9 per liter for much of the summer and fall. On Friday, gas at the Petro-Canada station on Joyce Avenue in the heart of Powell River was still $1.59.9, according to GasBuddy.com, although other nearby stations were charging a few cents less. Now, across the water in Courtenay on Vancouver Island, the price was $1.22.9 at Costco, which is a 37 cents per liter difference. And that's quite a big difference when you're filling up on a 70 or even 80 liter tank. Now, one resident who wrote to the BCUC said, quote, "Our gas in Powell River is the most expensive in North America. Powell River does not have a transit tax, so how is this happening? Why are we being charged so much?" But the report itself was short on answers, both for residents of Powell River and other BC communities with inexplicably high gas prices. That includes Chilliwack, where online message boards frequently highlight price discrepancies with neighboring Abbotsford, which is quite close to the U.S. border. And it also includes Squamish, where residents have planned a series of protests to draw attention to the difference between their gas prices and those in neighboring Vancouver and Pemberton. Now, Squamish, which is just north of Vancouver, Now, the prices there are typically higher than those in Vancouver, even though there is no TransLink tax outside Metro Vancouver. Now, while gas prices in Vancouver were between $1.29 and $1.32 on Friday, the cheapest gas in Squamish was $1.43.9, according to GasBuddy.com. And while some of the difference might be attributed to transportation costs, gas in Pemberton, which is almost 100 kilometers further north on Highway 99, was at $1.32.9, just like Vancouver was. Now, what no BC media is willing to talk about is how increased supply from the Trans Mountain pipeline could actually lower gas prices. And while much of the focus and the protest is on increased export capacity to market through increased tanker traffic, a twinned line could also provide for more specialized products like airline fuel and refined petroleum, which would not only lower gas prices, but also airline prices as well. And one famous quote that could be attributed to this situation is, quote, "I've tried nothing and I'm all out of ideas." Now, perhaps then, rather than attributing more work to the BCUC and doing a lot of hand-wringing in the meantime, the BCNDP could put more focus on getting more concessions on spill responses from the federal government rather than continuing to try and blockade a major resource project in the national interest. And at the end of the day, it's ordinary BC residents who are suffering.
And this is something that is very apparent. You go into Alberta, you see we still have gas prices below the $1 mark. And this is, of course, right now for the time being. And we could only be so fortunate it to continue into the new year that we currently have no carbon tax here in Alberta. And we also do have the ability to produce our own here. And, you know, as you mentioned, there's the issue with the refineries in BC. Yes, the Trans Mountain Pipeline is another. And I'm wondering if there's anywhere in this inquiry or report that will talk about the taxation structure that BC sees as well, because that's not something that we've heard about all too much. But if you look back to, say, the Ontario provincial campaign last year, you'll see that is something that Doug Ford definitely campaigned on, was lowering the gas tax for commuters in Ontario, and that was certainly fairly well received when his government enacted that.
Yeah, and the BCUC did talk a little bit about the taxes, and it actually took away the taxes and just looked at the station markup on gas and what it was charging for it wholesale in different places. And even trucks that are able to fill up at a reduced rate for tanker trucks, they're still getting charged even more so in the Lower Mainland than they are even just outside of the Lower Mainland in places like Kamloops and Kelowna. And that is certainly quite interesting how there is this 13-cent markup that can't even be explained away by taxes, but it all comes down to business signals and what the government is able to do to try and stop this from going up. And certainly, ever since the BCNDP have taken power in BC, there haven't been many signals that have shown that they actually want the gas price to go down. Although they are certainly trying to look like they're doing something about it, it doesn't really appear that they actually are.
Yeah, and you know, we always talk about signals here, economic signals being very important for indicators as to whether people will want to invest. And if anybody is starting up a business that relies heavily on transport, that is certainly going to have an impact. And this is something that I would say, for the benefit of Canada, the Canadian economy, BC should try and get under control in the 2 weeks or so that's left in what seems like a really short legislative session this fall.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to move on to our Alberta story, but before we do that, I'll just take a moment and remind our listeners about our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext. And there we offer three tiers of support that you can offer to the podcast. For $2 a month, at the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, or the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that and have the name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production show notes throughout the entire week. And when we reach $25 a month in contributions, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month. We reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs may be headed next. At $50 a month, you can expect online town halls hosted every quarter. Topics of discussion will include the news of the month, the state of the media, and your questions. We also do have an option available at westerncolumntex.ca/support where you can make a one-time contribution via PayPal, and there you can also learn a bit more about our Patreon option as well. So once again, that's at westerncolumntex.ca/support. All right, so moving on into Alberta, we mentioned we'd be talking about what exactly the province talked about in terms of moving forward on equalization. And there was this event last weekend, the Manning Center Conference here in Alberta, asking what is next for the province in Western Canada. And, you know, this week the media is indeed talking about the expenses of Jason Kenney's top aide flying to London, which flying to London it's in itself is a very expensive endeavor. We'll have to wait and see how this pans out. We might end up talking about that at some point, or media would also like us to be talking about Bill 207, a private member's bill in the Alberta legislature, which reaffirms the conscience rights of doctors and healthcare professionals, basically allowing them to say that they don't want to perform a procedure that violates their conscience rights. They can't be fined or lose their job over that. Now, both of these measures do have significant criticism that has been placed on them by the media and the opposition NDP, but we are in a point here where Alberta and the West in general is in crisis. It seems like every week we have stories of companies that are shuttering their doors, laying off workers, and to top it all off, the oil drilling forecast for 2020 doesn't look very good. The future is a constant question for many in Alberta, and Alberta's great premiers from Ernest Manning to Peter Lougheed and Ralph Klein have always looked for that next edge to push the province forward into the next decade or so. For Manning, it was converting the province to an oil-based economy, for one that was based purely on agriculture. For Lougheed, it was modernizing Alberta and fighting Pierre Trudeau's national energy program. And for Ralph Klein, it was slaying the provincial debt and making Alberta one of, if not the most competitive areas to do business in the late 90s and early 2000s, creating the oil boom. Now, last weekend, we have Jason Kenney, who spoke at the Manning Center's What's Next conference. And the conference outlined the steps that Alberta could take, where the potential Trudeau minority government is likely to be propped up by the socialist NDP or the separatist Bloc Québécois, both of which ran platforms that were vigorously anti-oil and anti-resource development. Now, in his nearly hour-long speech, the premier announced that the government will be opening offices in Ottawa, Quebec, and BC to defend the province's interests. The government will also introduce the Citizens Initiative Act to give Albertans the power to petition for referenda on matters of widespread public concern. And for anybody wondering what that means, is that if there is a specific issue that Albertans want to bring forward to the government, but the government is not looking at it, you could get a collection of Albertans to look at that issue and then bring that to the government, and the government would be forced to act on that. And citizen-initiated referenda goes hand-in-hand with recall legislation in terms of two of the most direct-to-democracy ideas that a government could implement. And quite frankly, recall legislation and the Citizen Referenda Act were not in the UCP platform this spring, but it goes a long way to bringing government back to the people of Alberta. The government also says they'll continue to push for equalization reform. They'll also hold a referendum on removing equalization from the Constitution. If progress is not made on the Trans Mountain expansion and Bill C-69, the bill that overhauled the National Energy Board, is not amended or repealed, they're also committed to holding a referendum on entrenching property rights in the Constitution and much more. Though the biggest announcement in the Premier's speech came in the form of the Fair Deal panel, and this panel will consult with Albertans on the best way to secure a fair deal for Alberta, of course, based on its name. And in doing so, the panel will be asking if Alberta should implement the firewall protocol from 2003, as was signed by former Prime Minister Stephen Harper and former Alberta Finance Minister Ted Morton. Ted Morton was also at the Manning Conference this week and spoke in favor of many of these ideas. Things up for discussion by the panel include the establishment of a provincial revenue agency to collect taxes directly, the creation of an Alberta pension plan by withdrawing from the Canada pension plan, establishing a provincial police force and ending the contract with the federal RCMP, following Quebec's role of seeking Alberta representation in any trade or treaty negotiations that have Albertan interests, requiring that public bodies, which of course means municipalities, school boards, and more, obtain the approval of the provincial government before entering into agreements with the federal government, appointing a chief firearms officer to implement the Firearms Act in Alberta, opting out of the federal cost-sharing program, such as any PharmaCare program going forward, and seeking an exchange of tax points for federal transfers under the Canada Health and Social Transfers Program, allowing Alberta to spend the money as we see fit here in the province, and finally, adopting an official provincial constitution. Now, the tax collection idea and the Alberta pension plan would need to be examined from an economic perspective, but everything else is implementable and would give Alberta more autonomy. According to the Fraser Institute, over the past decade, Albertans have paid $27 billion more into the Canada pension plan than they have received. Now, this panel, for those wondering who will be on it, it includes known Albertans such as Preston Manning, Stephen Lougheed, the son of Premier Peter Lougheed. It's also worth noting, of course, that Preston Manning was the leader of the Federal Reform Party and was a son of Alberta Premier Ernest Manning. Also on this panel will be Arisa Lenny, Jason Goodstriker, Donna Kennedy Glanz, Moin Yahya, and three Alberta MLAs, including Drew Barnes, Miranda Rosin, and Tani Yao. Now, if this panel meets and Albertans suggest to implement all of the recommendations, Alberta will have effectively implemented a firewall around the province to mitigate slightly, the impact that decisions in Ottawa will have on the province. The groundwork, of course, with this, if all of these ideas were to be implemented, would be laid for some of the essentials that an independent Alberta would need. Now, why are we talking about this? It's not because we're all rushing for the door, pursuing the separatist angle, as many in the media would like to believe. If implemented, this would mark the largest political shift in Alberta in the way that business is conducted since Confederation. It also sets the stage for a potential independence movement. As I mentioned, it lays down many of the infrastructural requirements, like a provincial police force, a pension plan, and, of course, tax collection agencies, that if Alberta was independent, it would need these. And you have to ask yourselves, when did we last see a movement like this? It was, of course, promoted and suggested in the 90s, 80s, and early 2000s. But when was the time we actually had a panel to look at this? Never. And when were we close to actually implementing something like this? Never once again. Instead, the media, of course, wants to talk about egregious expenses, which we may very well talk about in the future here at Western Context at some point, and a private member's non-government bill that is being framed as reopening the abortion debate in the province. And to top it all off, NDP leader Rachel Notley said that Jason Kenney was, quote, intentionally stoking the fires of Western alienation. This is a point now where we're at in this province, where the future is being charted and the media is off chasing shiny objects, as they all so often do, as they did in the election campaign, the issues that matter on social media, but most Albertans aren't actually thinking about, when here we have perhaps one of the most consequential stories in Alberta history developing.
Yeah, exactly. These are very populist actions that are going to set Alberta ahead and certainly apart from the federal government, in the sense that they're going to be trying to isolate themselves a little bit from the decisions that Ottawa would have on them, which are increasingly being seen as more negative than positive. And things like the Alberta pension plan idea and things like reducing tax points and certainly having more control over their own spending is something that Alberta's will probably are looking at doing as a way to try and reduce the amount that goes to the federal government, but in a sense is trying to reduce waste as well. And I think that a lot of the options, such as the citizens' referenda, as well as the recall legislation, are direct democracy things that are straight from that populist playbook that has been around, you know, ever since the Reform Party had been on the scene, and has certainly not been seen very much of in the few years, but as seeing a bit of resurgence in the last couple of years. And I think that's something that the media has completely missed on this, is that a lot of the legislation that the Kenny government is going to put in for Alberta is likely going to be more prosperous for Alberta than it is to be detrimental. And I think that even though they are seemingly setting themselves up for an independent Alberta, likely that won't happen, and it likely will just put Alberta in a better position economically anyways.
Yeah, and you mentioned, of course, the keyword there, populist movement. And as we've talked about many times before here on Western Context, that word is thrown around in a negative light. And what we have here is the true bedrock of prairie conservative reform populism in Canada being implemented in Alberta. This is what Preston Manning set out to implement for the West when he created the Reform Party, which of course morphed into the Canadian Alliance and then merged into the Conservative Party of Canada with the Progressive Conservatives. And we saw Prime Minister Stephen Harper from the Reform Party and Canadian Alliance not implement any of these ideas nationally. But lo and behold, here we are 15, 20 years later, implementing them in Alberta. And that speaks to the changes that have gone on in Ottawa, not only under the Trudeau era, but pretty much all through history, leading back to the first Trudeau government back in the 1970s. And that is what this is all culminating in. And this is why this is a story that the media should definitely be watching, because it is a transformation that we really seldomly see here in Canada, and that's what makes it interesting, and they're missing out on that. But one thing that the media definitely talked about a lot this week was Don Cherry, and that's her firing line, which we got a lot to talk about, and this is just one story that got so much bigger than it should have.
Yeah, exactly. This is the firing line segment that we use to talk about a story that's either not been discussed in the media, it's been discussed too much in the media, or it's been discussed unfairly. And I think certainly this one has been blown up way further than it should have been. And not often does hockey become a major political story nationwide. But a week after it happened, people are still talking about it. And if you turn on a news station right now as we speak at that time of recording, you're more likely to find out more drivel on Donald Trump's impeachment proceedings. But of course, if you wait through that, you're likely to find journalists still talking about Poppygate. And this is, of course, hockey icon Don Cherry's supposed divisive and discriminatory rant on Hockey Night in Canada last Saturday about you people not wearing poppies on Remembrance Day to support our military troops and veterans. Let's have a listen so we get the full context of what exactly he said.
You know, I was talking to a veteran. I said, I'm not going to run the poppy thing anymore, because what's the sense? I live in Mississauga. Nobody wears, very few people wear a poppy. Downtown Toronto, forget it, downtown Toronto, nobody wears a poppy. And I'm not going to wait. He says, wait a minute. How about running it for the people that buy them? Now, you go to the small cities, and you know those, the rows on rows, you people love, you that come here, whatever it is, you love our way of life, you love our milk and honey. At least you could pay a couple of bucks for poppies or something like that. These guys pay for your way of life that you enjoy in Canada. These guys paid the biggest price. Anyhow, I'm going to run it.
Yeah, so he was, of course, talking about a segment that he always does on Hockey Night in Canada, where he is going to run a specific segment about something going on that he feels strongly about. In this particular case, it was the Military Remembrance Day and wearing poppies, of course. And he did, in fact, run a segment which talked about his great uncle who perished in the Great War and how he visited his grave in the in the graves row on row that were our military dead in the war that gave us our freedom. And now, before we go even further, though, I just want to be clear. I'm not really that big of a fan of Don Cherry himself, and I personally think his commentary over the years has been biased towards certain Eastern hockey teams, and that his views are rather outdated, especially on European players, on the French language in hockey, and certainly about the West, and that he probably should have retired years ago. And I think that's saying one thing, and it's fine to not like a commentator for what they're saying, but I do admire the man for his tireless passion for hockey and his advocacy for the military veterans who are so often overlooked by their government and their country. And I have a feeling that, love him or hate him, lots of people feel that way about Don Cherry. He's very much a no-nonsense man who doesn't mince words or waste time, and I respect that. But, however, these last Don Cherry rant that he went on about poppies seemed to grab the country in a way that I think he certainly wasn't expecting, and I certainly wasn't expecting. And the whole issue blew up on Twitter. And the fact that he said, "you people," a lot of people took that to mean immigrants, and that it was a racist or bigoted rant. And when I originally saw the clip, and when I saw it for the first time on Saturday, I didn't really even think that much about it. I just thought "you people" meant Canadians in general, as in people coming here to the city of Toronto, to Mississauga, where Cherry lives, people in general just going there and not wearing poppies and not supporting the troops that have given us the ability to have free speech. And I think that was something that a lot of people thought, but certainly a lot of people disagreed with. And Bart Yabsley, who is the president of Rogers Sportsnet, said in a statement after Cherry's remarks that, quote, "Don's discriminatory comments are offensive and they do not represent our values and what we stand for as a network. We have spoken with Don about the severity of this issue, and we sincerely apologize for these divisive remarks." Now, Don Cherry, who is a passionate supporter of veterans in the Canadian military, would not back down from his words, however, saying that he meant what he said. And, of course, there was a furor on social media after this, with left-wing politicians and journalists alike taking to Twitter to condemn Cherry's "you people" comments, including Toronto Mayor John Tory, Mississauga Mayor Bonnie Crombie, and CBC reporter Amr Khan, among others. And following this, Sportsnet decided to fire Don Cherry, but they didn't just fire Don Cherry, they fired Don Cherry on Remembrance Day, which upstaged the one day of the year that's dedicated to the people who have defended our Canadian values, including free speech. Now, Yabsley's statement after the firing read that sports brings people together. It unites us, not divides us. But ironically, in firing Don Cherry on Remembrance Day, it didn't really note how the firing itself actually divided the nation further on the issue. Now, Yabsley went further and said, quote, "Following further discussions with Don Cherry after Saturday night's broadcast, it has been decided it is the right time for him to immediately step down. During the broadcast, he made divisive remarks that do not represent our values or what we stand for. Don is synonymous with hockey and has played an integral role in growing the game over the past 40 years. We would like to thank Don for his contributions to hockey and sports broadcasting in Canada." Now, the NHL, for their part, called Cherry's comments offensive and contrary to their values. Now, Toronto Sun columnist Joe Warmington took to a busy downtown Toronto street to count how many people walking past actually had poppies. And despite there being a veteran selling poppies in front of a store about 20 feet away, no one went up to him in the two-minute video, and only three people were counted wearing poppies out of the hundreds of people walking past. And this was just on November 9th, which is just a few days before Remembrance Day. Now, Cherry, for his part, said that his dismissal came down to his poor phrasing of "you," using the words "you people." And he added that his many good deeds that have happened over the years, he mentioned helping Montreal Canadiens forward Max Domi with the launch of his book on growing up with diabetes, All of these events are being overshadowed just by his word choice. And he said, quote, not a word was said about that, but you use two words and that's where it goes. And in retrospect, he sees how he could have made his point differently. And he said, quote, I think it was a mistake, but I think the big thing was that I should have said everybody. That was the big, big thing. Now, many hockey players were asked for their comments, and a lot of them echoed the same thoughts, that it was disappointing to see Cherry fired after decades of advocacy for hockey and for the military. And Cherry's fans know that sometimes his grape speak style crunches so many thoughts together that the context can be lost. And certainly, by taking his quotes out of context, you can frame it in a worse light than what it is. But I think it's pretty clear that over the last few years, he's shown with his actions that he doesn't really care if you're new to the country or born here. He just doesn't want people to forget the safe and prosperous lifestyle that we enjoy here thanks to those who fought or died in war. And he just wanted the focus put back on Remembrance Day. Unfortunately, being fired on Remembrance Day, the most important day of the year for him, felt like a stab in the back. And speaking of stabs in the back, Cherry's coach's corner partner Ron McLean metaphorically did just that to Cherry. On Twitter, McLean said that he wanted to, quote, to sincerely apologize to our viewers and Canadians. During last night's broadcast, Don made comments that were hurtful and prejudiced, and I wished I had handled myself differently. It was a divisive moment, and I am truly upset with myself for allowing it. And he said, quote, diversity is one of our country's greatest strengths. McLean said he worked with Don for 30 years, but feels we've failed you. Now, it's ironic that when McLean was fired from his broadcast chair twice, it was actually Don Cherry who was working behind the scenes to actually bring him back and get him his job again. But when Cherry was fired, McLean was nowhere to be found. Now, the slow news week that we have talked about let every commentator across the country talk about the firing. Jessica Allen, who was on CTV's The Social Talk Show, which is kind of like the U.S.'s The View, and exactly in the sense that it was for daytime television and likely has a lot of women on it to discuss views that they don't really know that much about, quite honestly. She was on there and described hockey players as white boys and bullies while scolding parents for spending money on the sport. Allen said that while she had been told that Cherry is a Canadian icon and a symbol of the great sport of hockey, she doesn't, quote, worship at the altar of hockey. And the reason she gave was that, quote, a certain type of person in my mind, in my experience, who does, and, quote, they all tended to be white boys who are, let's say, not very nice. And she added that they were not generally thoughtful. They were often bullies. Their parents were able to afford to spend $5,000 a year on minor hockey. $5,000 is a lot of money. You can do lots of things other than spending time in an arena. And she said that they could go on a trip and learn about the world, see other things. The world is a big place. Get outside of that bubble. For me, Don Cherry is the walking and talking representative of that type. And although she acknowledged that he has done some good things, she said that Cherry is still a bigot and a misogynist. Now, one thing that's different from what Cherry said last Saturday was that he didn't actually refer to or single out any race or skin color or females or males or even mention immigrants. And Allen was actually the one who did that by spouting out the racist rant that it was all just a bunch of white boy bullies. Now, Thursday evening, Allen tweeted a statement where she says that she regrets, quote, saying my experiences were personal instead of underlying that they were specific episodes from determined moments with particular individuals. As a result, I offended many people, not just our viewers, but parents, children, coaches, volunteers, and hockey families everywhere. To you, I apologize, but I still can't apologize to the very specific hockey players I was referring to on Tuesday. I wish I'd used my voice and privilege more back then. So she didn't actually give an apology for her racist comments, and the statements that CTV put out on her behalf was atrocious. CTV on Twitter said that, quote, CTV's The Social is based on opinion and debate about current issues, and we often hear from viewers who don't agree with some of the perspectives on the show. However, Jessica Allen's comments about hockey have generated an extraordinary response. We've been touched by the stories we've heard from Canadians everywhere, including families from Humboldt, about what the game means to them. That matters to us. We would like to apologize to everyone who was offended by the remarks and let you know that your feedback sparked much debate and introspection at the social and CTV. We won't restrict our hosts from offering their opinions on an opinion show, but we've always listened to viewers when they've offered theirs. And I get what you're thinking right now. This is pretty unbelievable, right? When a beloved, if at times abrasive, hockey icon tries to get more Canadians to wear poppies, he's fired. But when a hateful and racist woman speaks about hockey as full of white boy bullies, she can't even see how that was wrong. And this is the standard of political correctness in our country, and our biased and sensationalist media encourages it. Rather than act to help focus on the military and veterans on Remembrance Day like John Cherry wanted, instead, we're inundated with awful opinions about our national pastime and culture. And quite frankly, it's disgusting.
It is disgusting. And this is the same kind of mental gymnastics from the media and from, let's just say, in large progressive groups that let Justin Trudeau get off with wearing blackface numerous times and not be held to account when any other leader would have to resign in this fact. And one thing that is needs to be underscored with this is that Don Cherry and Coach's Corner is a part of the TV channel Sportsnet, which is owned by the same parent company, Bell, that owns CTV. And that just increases the hypocrisy in this story to a whole other level that if you're looking at it from, you know, let's just say a distance away, maybe you're in a different country, you're going to see this as two different stories, maybe two different networks. But indeed, Sportsnet is a part of the CTV broadcasting family in that regard. And that just throws a whole new level of hypocrisy into this. And there's also, it's also worth noting that the Straczynski family, one of the survivors from the Humboldt crash, has said that they'll be boycotting all CTV interviews over these comments that were made on the social. And, you know, recall that back when the horrific Humboldt bus crash happened, the media coverage seemed like for weeks on end we were talking about that bus crash, and indeed we even talked about some of the insensitive stories surrounding that. And keep in mind that at the time those hockey players on that bus were the stars of the Canadian media. Everybody wanted to talk about them, rightfully, because it was such a huge tragic crash. But on the same hand, year and a half, almost 2 years later, it's allowed to effectively call hockey a white boy bully sport, which, of course, strikes at the very heart of the surviving families of the Humboldt Broncos, which is something that, you know, if this had happened, say, a few months after that crash, I think we would be maybe having a different idea. But maybe just the way that the varying degrees of progressive points and privilege work in the modern era, as espoused by CTV and social media types and progressives in general, maybe the people at the social would have come out on top of that. No one can really know for certain.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when you actually go and look at minor hockey and go to kids, look at kids' teams that are playing out everywhere, you see huge amounts of diversity. I mean, Canada has been a changing population over the past 10 years, and hockey isn't just a white person sport anymore. Maybe it used to be 20 to 30 years ago, but it certainly has changed quite a bit. Even in the NHL, where the 600 top players in the world play, and where there's a very high bar for players to actually get into, we've seen increasing numbers of diverse sets of people that have been showing up in it. And it's not just a white person sport anymore, like maybe it used to be. And I think that what's missing from Jessica Allen's comments and the reaction to Jessica Allen's comments is that people are, by CTV not actually censoring her or firing her or doing anything on that remark, it provides a double standard. And this double standard is surrounding the cancel culture that we've been seeing so much of in the last few years, especially, where someone says something you don't like, And there's a movement on social media and elsewhere to try and get that person either fired from their job or blacklisted from ever actually being able to speak up on anything ever again. And quite frankly, I think the whole culture is disgusting, no matter what the side is of that they're speaking on. I personally don't think that Jessica Allen should be fired, because I don't think that people like that should be fired from their jobs, but I certainly think that she should apologize for her racist remarks and to mention that they were racist, because characterizing a whole sport that our whole country, large part, enjoys as being part of just one race is very much racist to the people that aren't white that do enjoy the sport and that are a part of the sport. And I think that's something that was missing, is that there is a huge double standard here, and that Don Cherry was fired and people were calling for his firing, but there was a lot of supporters that wanted him to stay on. And I think that getting rid of him and not having people like Jessica Allen fired, it does provide a bit of a double standard.
Indeed. And, you know, looking at this, this is something that is going to evolve over time. Unless someone takes a stand on it, it's going to keep happening, and people are going to keep rewarding this. And that's not, quite frankly, the world we want to live in. And that takes us nicely into our word of the week, which is indeed double standard.
Yes, and double standard is, of course, defined as a rule or principle that is unfairly applied in different ways to different people or groups. And I think the double standard has shown quite starkly in this firing line segment on Don Cherry and the words "you people," which, you know, could have referred to anyone, but certainly a lot of people took it to mean one way when it wasn't. And I think we could also see a bit of a double standard in the equalization story, where there is a bit of a double standard on which provinces get to send money to Ottawa on behalf of other provinces. And we might have even see a bit of a double standard in the BC gas price story, where certain communities are paying way more in gas prices than other communities not that far away from them. And certainly we are seeing more and more double standards in 2019. And we're hoping that as 2019 comes to a close, that we don't see that in 2020.
Indeed, and that pretty much wraps up this episode of Western Context. If you want full show notes, you can find those at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, anything under the sun at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And you can also find us on social media on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share the show and the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week. So we'll see you guys again next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all the stories that the media talks about and some that they don't talk about, just so you can get the full context of what is being said and cut through all that bias and sensationalism, no matter where it appears. If it's print, online, on radio, or even on the television, no matter where it is, we will find it for you and cover it so you have the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. And with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.